This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. Our guest this morning is Nalini Nadkarni, a member of the faculty at the Evergreen State College, where she teaches in the Environmental Studies program. Her research is focused on the ecology of tropical and temperate forest canopies, particularly the role that canopy-dwelling plants play in forests at the ecosystem level. In 1994, she co-founded and is president of the International Canopy Network, a nonprofit organization that fosters communication among researchers, educators, and conservationists concerned with forest canopies. Nalini Nadkarni was most recently on the Sustainability segment last November to discuss her recent book, Between Earth and Sky, Our Intimate Connections to Trees. She returns today to tell us about forest canopies and their ecological importance. Welcome, Nalini.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Would you begin by generally defining and describing the forest canopy?
Yes, I would be happy to. I think everyone's familiar, actually, with a forest canopy, even if he or she has never actually climbed up into it. But it's that part of any forest that is basically in the upper part of it. That's kind of the non-technical definition of it. Scientists have recently defined it as being the leaves, the stems, the twigs, and the air, or the interstices of the forest high above the forest floor.
And what are some of the plants found in the canopy?
Well, there are many, many species of plants that live exclusively in the forest canopy. They're called epiphytes. Epi means upon, and phyte means plant. So these plants, which range from little tiny green mosses to splendiferous orchids and ferns and bromeliads that grow in the rainforest canopies in the tropics, these plants derive their support from trees, but not their nutrients. So they don't have any connection to the vascular system of the trees themselves, which makes them really interesting because you have to wonder, well, then where are they getting their nutrients? Where are they getting their water like most normal plants? And as it turns out, these plants that live up in the canopy get their nutrients and water from rainfall and from mist. And so they're living sort of quasi-independently of the rest of the forest, and yet, as my own research has uncovered, relate to the forest as a whole.
And what types of animals live in the canopy?
All kinds of animals. When I go to my tropical rainforest sites in Costa Rica, for example, I see howler monkeys, I see sloths, I see olingas, I see arboreal snakes and lizards. And the animals here in the temperate rainforest, where we live here in the Pacific Northwest, we see all kinds of birds that are really not discernible from the forest floor. There are slugs, there are snails, there are arboreal mammals, there are flying squirrels, there are red voles that sort of glide from one place to another. And so I think what has really amazed canopy researchers and people who are studying the canopies in the last 20 years as we've been able to get up into them has been this realization that there's really a whole other world up there in terms of the organisms that have evolved, have adapted to living their lives up there.
Well, you've already alluded to this somewhat, but how is the forest canopy different from the ecosystem on the ground?
That's a great question. And basically, if you and I, Diane, were to walk out into a patch of forest and just stay on the ground, we would sense that it's quite moist, quite dark. In most forests, only about 2% of the light that comes to the top of the forest actually makes it to the forest floor. We'd sense that there's very little wind, very small differences in relative humidity between the day and the night, because it is so protected by the overlying branches. But if I put a harness on you and put a harness on me and we went up to the forest canopy, what we'd experience is a really different microclimate, much sunnier, much windier, greater extremes of relative humidity and temperature, and really more like the atmosphere of an open field. And so that contrasting set of microenvironments, as we say, really presents the plants and animals that live up there with a very different sort of habitat to live in.
Would you say more about the special adaptations of the plants and animals who live in the canopy?
Sure. Well, when you think about a canopy environment, not only is the microclimate different, but the whole topography is different, the whole lay of the land. So if you're a monkey, for example, you can't fly around in the canopy. You have to make your way from one branch to another. And so branches represent these sort of safe spaces between which is this enormous chasm of dangerous canyon that if you miss jumping from one branch directly, that you're toast. And so canopy animals have really had to evolve and adapt to hold on. Now, some of them have adapted amazing hands with that prehensile, with that opposable thumb, and very strong hands. Primates and other animals can really hold on very tightly. Others have developed prehensile tails, so olingas and woolly possums and any number of mammals that have adapted to being able to hold on with that sort of fifth limb of their tail. Plants, on the other hand, have these holdfast roots. The epiphytes have these quite amazing holdfast roots that aren't useful for absorbing nutrients and water, but are very good at holding on to branches of different sizes, even during windstorms, even during rainstorms. But perhaps the most amazing adaptation on the part of plants who live in the canopy is their ability to absorb water and the nutrients that are contained in rainfall through their leaves. Many of them, like certain bromeliads, have hairs or trichomes that line the inside wall of their leaves. And those hairs are capable of taking up water and nutrients directly into the plant rather than having to go through the root system, as we know trees and other terrestrial plants do. So there's this sort of enormous array of really fascinating adaptations, both behavioral and morphological, meaning both in terms of how they behave, but also what they're shaped like, what their form is like, and even physiological in terms of how they have adapted to life in the treetops.
How is the tropical rainforest canopy different from the canopy in a temperate forest, for example, here in the Pacific Northwest?
Tropical rainforests and temperate rainforests share many characteristics, that they're more exposed to sunlight, for instance, than their below-ground counterparts. But the tropical rainforest canopy has a tremendous diversity of plants and animals that we simply don't have here in the Pacific Northwest. There, you know, you can find one single branch that has perhaps 25 different flowering plants just going bonkers all at the same time, with hummingbirds and butterflies and arboreal mammals coming in to do pollination and fruit dispersal all at the same time. So it's like this giant Safeway supermarket just right before your eyes. Whereas in the temperate zone, it maintains a diversity. I mean, I can find 50 different species of mosses and lichens on a single big leaf maple tree, but it all seems kind of quieter. It's all more a bit dampened because the diversity of the vascular plants is very much reduced. And most of the plants that live in the canopy are mosses and lichens and liverworts, things that don't have showy flowers and yet have a tremendously important ecological role in rainforest nutrient cycles and other aspects of rainforest ecology.
Where are the temperate forests that have canopies found in our area?
In our area, the best examples, the most well-developed canopy communities are in the wettest forests that we have. And those are on the west side of the Olympic Peninsula, in what we call the true Olympic rainforest. So the four river systems on the west side, the Hoh River, the Bogashiel, the Quinault, and the Queets, when you go up those river systems, when you visit the Olympic National Park and just look at those big leaf maple trees, and look up at them, you'll just see this amazing fairyland of mosses, lichens, club mosses, just dripping from every single branch and trunk.
I'm Diane Horn, and we are speaking with Nalini Nadkarni, a member of the faculty at the Evergreen State College. Our topic is forest canopies and their ecological importance. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. What is the ecological importance of the forest canopy?
Well, the forest canopy, as I've mentioned a couple times, really actually presents the forest with a very important portion in terms of its biodiversity, as I mentioned, all of these hundreds and hundreds of species. But what I get really excited and interested in is what its ecological roles are. What are those plants and animals in the canopy doing in and for the forest as a whole? And one of the important things that the canopy plants do is absorb nutrients and water from rainfall and mist that pass through it. They're very efficient. They've evolved these mechanisms of very efficiently absorbing and retaining nutrients that are contained in rainfall. And let me just take a little sidestep here and explain that although we think of rainfall as being this pure water, actually, when you think about what a raindrop is, it starts by being a tiny little speck, a tiny little bit of particulate matter, a little speck of dust, which itself contains a bit of nitrogen and phosphorus and so forth. And around that, water vapor has coalesced. And that gets bigger and bigger. More and more water vapor coalesces around that little bit of particulate matter until it's heavy enough to actually become a raindrop and fall to the earth. Well, that means that if you hold out a cup and just catch rainwater, you're also, within that rainwater, also catching small dilute amounts of nitrogen and phosphorus and magnesium and calcium and all those little bits that are dissolved in the rainfall. And it is that, those nutrients, those macronutrients, those necessary nutrients that these canopy plants are sieving out of rainfall for their own nutrient needs. So they're really sort of like sponges that are attached to these branches that are just sucking up nutrients and water from rainfall and mist that pass over it. Well, they live with that. They have them contained in their leaves and all the organic matter that they accumulate over their lives. And when they die, they can fall to the forest floor and they start decomposing. And those nutrients then that were taken out of the rainfall then are returned to the forest floor and available for trees, shrubs, slugs, bugs, microorganisms, anybody else that might be catching on to these nutrients. And so in that way, the epiphytes, the canopy-dwelling plants that are absorbing and retaining and then moving on these nutrients, are really acting in some ways as capacitors. They're catching these nutrients, holding on to them for a short time, and then moving them through the ecosystem as a whole. And what we've learned with experiments where we've stripped off these epiphytes is that without them, there's actually a smaller amount of nutrients that the ecosystem as a whole can have and hold on to because those initial absorbers of the atmospheric nutrients have disappeared. So saying that in a shorter way, these epiphytes, these canopy-dwelling plants, are really efficient at absorbing and retaining nutrients and then passing them on, and thereby sort of augmenting the nutrient capital of the forest as a whole.
What is the role of the forest canopy in climate change?
That's another really good question, and one that unfortunately we don't have as much evidence as we like. We know that these epiphytes are very sensitive to atmospheric changes because they're reliant, especially in the tropics, on the delivery of water and nutrients in the form of mist and rain. Anything in terms of world climate or regional climate that upsets that is going to have a negative effect on these epiphytes. And I have done some experiments of transplanting mats of epiphytes from high up on a tropical mountain where there's lots and lots of mist and fog down lower where there's less mist and fog, and have basically quantified and documented what has happened. And what we've learned, in at least with the four target species that we looked at, is that the reduction in mist and fog actually has a very strong negative effect on these epiphytic plants, and they start dying off. They don't get enough water. They don't get enough nutrients as a result of this reduced mist and fog, which is what is predicted for global climate change in the future in these tropical mountains. So what we can say at this point is that if we get the predicted changes in atmospheric conditions, that is a reduction in the amount of mist and rain in these tropical cloud forests, we're going to see a concomitant decrease or reduction in their productivity and their growth rates, which in turn can have a negative feedback effect in terms of how much more nutrients can be absorbed by these plants and passed on to other parts of the ecosystem. So at this point, we're very much reduced to a few experimental studies, a few anecdotal observations in these mountains and in other tropical rainforests, and these sort of large-level global climate change models that we're all relying on in terms of trying to understand what the predictions will be. So we're working with only, you know, a few little pieces of the puzzle, trying to figure out what the picture is going to be in the future. And canopy researchers now are really moving forward as quickly as they can to ask and answer the question that you've posed about global climate change, because it is one that we fear will have a negative consequence.
In addition to climate change, in what other ways is the canopy endangered ecologically?
Well, in certain forests and in certain bioregions, harvesting of canopy-dwelling plants, we've found, is to have a negative effect, and it's something that we're very concerned about. One of the plants that grows very lushly in old-growth forests are mosses, and they're beautiful. They're important ecologically. Birds, many bird species use them to make their nests, but because the floriculture trade is very interested in having them harvested to use them in bouquets or packing bulbs, $265 million a year industry has evolved in the Pacific Northwest to harvest these epiphytic mosses. And now we're learning, scientists are learning, that these mosses do not grow back quickly. They take a very long time to grow back, on the order of many decades. And so if these are being harvested more and more, and it's taking decades and decades to grow them back, we know that that's not a sustainable operation. And so some canopy researchers now are very concerned about this practice. They've convinced the U.S. Forest Service and the U.S. Park Service to stop issuing permits to harvest mosses because of this. And that has happened, which is really great. But the fact is, the floriculture trade really still wants this material. And I think it's great that people want mosses, you know, on their windowsills and in their floral bouquets and so forth. But it seems to me that the answer to this then is not so much enforcing or preventing people from harvesting, but rather learning how to farm these epiphytic mosses. And so one of the projects that I and my colleagues have been working on is figuring out how to grow these mosses, not in the forest, but rather outside of it. And we've been tapping into the idea of having partners in prisons, of engaging prisoners in helping us learn how to farm mosses for the horticulture trade rather than for us to go out and harvest them unsustainably from the old growth forests. So we've been going on for about 3 years. We've been working with incarcerated men at a number of prisons to learn how to grow epiphytic mosses in order to solve this environmental problem of unsustainable harvesting.
What other conservation efforts are currently underway to preserve the forest canopy?
I think that the major efforts that are going on right now to preserve the forest canopy involve a couple things. One is simply conservation, restoration, and mindfulness of forests as a whole. And I think that that awareness, the awareness of how important our forests are to humans, is rising very happily. I think people are recognizing that both in the tropics and here on our own home turf, how important it is to leave forests as intact as possible, to set aside some forests and parks, whether they be national parks or state parks or private reserves. Understanding at the same time that we need resources, we desperately as humans need resources of lumber, of paper, and of other forest products, and we need to harvest those in a mindful way. So I think there's just a general sense of conservation that's going on, and many organizations like the Nature Conservancy, for instance, its Great Bear Project in British Columbia and Alaska is a great project that's mindful of old growth forests, but also the need to extract certain resources in a sustainable way. In addition to that, I think there's a lot of awareness building that is going on with ecotourism. And I think people who go down to Costa Rica, they find out, oh, wow, there's a zip line. We can go and take a real cool, thrilling ride, you know, through the canopy. Although there's not a lot of education and direct conservation right now that's at those zip lines, my belief is that once you've seen the canopy, even if it's like in 10 seconds just flying through it on a zip line in Costa Rica, there is an awareness that's raised that, oh my gosh, there's another world up here. There's all this diversity. There are all these cool things going on that pertain to the forest up here, that people will have a sense of, let's pay attention to that. Maybe I can reduce my consumption of some material like tropical mahogany wood because I have a connection to that forest now because I took that amazing zip line ride through it. So I think that in addition to specific conservation projects, there is a growing awareness of the wonders of the canopy through the joy, the entertainment value, if you will, that comes to people who have chosen to take a trip to the tropics and take a look at the canopy, either by going on a walkway or along a zip line, or simply taking a moment to look up when you visit a forest ecosystem.
You are listening to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Nalini Nadkarni, a member of the faculty at the Evergreen State College. Our topic is forest canopies and their ecological importance. What do you see as the most important unanswered questions about the forest canopy?
Well, I think there are so many unanswered questions. They're so important. I could take the rest of the day here at your studio to talk about them. But as I've been kind of trying to synthesize and understand where forest canopy research is right now, I think there are a few areas. One of them, and this is kind of maybe a more obscure area than when you might think in terms of like, wow, that's so important. But that is understanding the microbes in the canopy, the fungi, the bacteria. I mean, that is a total black box in terms of our understanding because microbiologists, maybe, you know, they're not tree climbers. I don't know what it is. But there's a world of microorganisms that are not visible, obviously, with the naked eye as a monkey is or an orchid is. That, you know, we don't even know, is it a different fauna that live up there? Is it separate? Are they the same? How do they get up there? And most importantly, perhaps, what are they doing up there ecologically in terms of decomposition, in terms of pathogens? What's going on in the world of canopy microorganisms? And I think that it's not all just sort of for the microbiologists in their lab. I think there are questions for humans in that, obviously, there are many fungi and bacteria that might constitute effective medicines, effective routes of health for humans as well, just as we have a lot of antibiotics that are derived from soil microorganisms on the forest floor. There may well be a whole retinue of microorganisms that could be effective antibiotics that we desperately need. As you know, a lot of our medicines are just sort of beginning to fall apart because of resistant strains of pathogens. So I think there's really a practical reason as well as an intellectual reason in terms of studying canopy microorganisms. A second area is one that you mentioned, and that is global climate change and how that affects canopy organisms and in turn the forest as a whole. A third area is studying canopy plants and animals in human-affected ecosystems. Urban trees, for example. Trees that are left in agricultural settings like pastures. Very often in Costa Rica, I know many of my neighbors there will leave one or two trees when they clear a forest for pastures. And I say, well, why did you leave that tree right there? Some of them say, well, it gives shade to my cows. Others say, well, you know, it has fruits that are useful to me. And others say, I just like having a tree in my pasture. It's a beautiful thing to see when I walk around in the mornings. And so there are canopy plants and animals significantly that use those isolated trees. And there's a body of research that has started probably about a decade ago that has begun to see that trees that are left in pastures actually serve as what they called regeneration foci. That is, they become a focus for regeneration of forest underneath those trees because birds fly across the pastures, land in the tree, they have some fruit in their mouth or they eat a fruit and they poop out seeds and it lands underneath that tree. And that's then where seedlings and saplings start to get going. So I think that although most canopy researchers like myself were attracted to the field because it meant we could stride out into the middle of this beautiful, you know, primary forest and spend our days and nights studying these fantastic trees in a primary rainforest setting, a number of us canopy researchers are now turning towards pasture settings and agricultural settings and oil palm plantations and secondary forests and regrowing forests here in the Pacific Northwest on private forest land, on Weyerhaeuser land and Green Diamond land, because we're recognizing that a growing proportion, a larger and larger proportion of forest is in these settings. And we cannot just restrict our studies to primary forests in parks that are locked up and kept away from humans. We have to understand that there are not only important questions, but interesting questions in these secondary sort of human-affected ecosystems as well. So I think that's really a frontier in terms of canopy research. And a final one I'll say is the frontier of stretching our own scientific borders beyond just science and inviting partners of all kinds, especially partners who are artists, to come and join us in the canopy to help us see with fresh eyes and communicate with fresh tools the wonders, the questions, and the answers that we're collecting in the canopy. So I see in the future artists and musicians and people of all kinds joining scientists in the canopy in order to help them understand the diversity and the importance of these organisms.
Would you now like to tell us about some of your outreach activities to engage citizens with the canopy?
Sure. Well, coming off of what I just said, I have believed in engaging artists, especially to help me in my studies and for me to help them with their creative work. And one of the results of this kind of a partnership is actually a result of that will be presented here in Seattle in just a couple of months. About a year ago, I was approached by a modern dancer named Jody Lomask from San Francisco, and she is a choreographer and the director of the modern dance group called Capacitor. And she had in her heart a desire to make a dance about rainforest that was true. And she thought the best way to do that would be to engage a scientist who studies rainforests. So she called me and she proposed that we work together, collaborate on a project whereby she would create a modern dance about rainforests. And I would contribute to that effort by taking her and her dance troupe to a rainforest and spend some time there together so I could communicate what I know about rainforest biology to her and her dancers. And that's exactly what happened. We all went to Costa Rica to my long-term study sites together and spent 10 days in the rainforest. I talked to her and her dancers about the things we were seeing, strangler figs and roosting bats and glass frogs and the soil layers. And she listened very carefully, and the dancers began dancing and translating that, so to speak, into the dance that they ultimately created, a dance they called Biome. And they came back to San Francisco and finished that up. And we have now been performing that dance at various places. And what we're going to be doing in Seattle is presenting that jointly. Not that I'm going to dance, which I wish I could, but what I will be doing is introducing the performance with a short scientific piece about the complexity and the fragility of the cloud forest as I've learned it from a scientific approach. And then Jody and her seven dancers will dance this amazing 75-minute, just incredible dance about the rainforest as interpreted through movement and sound. And then we've arranged for a number of environmental and science education groups to be in the lobby: the Nature Conservancy, the Audubon Society, the International Canopy Network, the Pacific Science Center, the Washington Native Plant Society. So they'll have staff and materials right in the lobby so that audience members can be educated by my talk and inspired by the dance, and then hopefully they'll be moved to take some sort of action by signing up for a restoration activity by the Audubon Society, or to visit a Nature Conservancy site, or to become a member of the International Canopy Network. So that's a way that I see science joining hands with an artist in order to affect conservation. And I really believe that that is an effective way of the whole piece, of not just doing science in isolation or art in isolation or conservation in isolation for that matter, but allowing them to blend as I think they can.
If listeners were to go out to the Olympic Peninsula and try to look in the forest canopy, what should they be on the lookout for as they glance up into the canopy?
Well, I think if I were taking a walk with those people, taking a walk out into the Olympics, the first thing I would tell them would be just to lie down. Just lie down on your back and look up at the canopy. And note what it looks like. Note the configuration of it, the architecture, the way branches overlap each other, the way sunlight still comes down despite the overlapping. And after they lay down on the ground in one place, I would ask them to go to another part of the forest and lie down there and look up. And I might ask them to maybe pull out a sketch pad and just make a sketch of the forms that they're seeing, because those forms really inform, so to speak, they create the landscape that these canopy plants and animals have to live with. And I think they would notice that it's very irregular. There are just large places in between the branches that epiphytes and canopy animals have to deal with. But after they get up off the ground and sort of start walking around, I would ask them to look up as best they can to see what sort of plants they can see on the, you know, from for sort of the bottom up. And they'll see some drippy things that are coming down that look like mosses but are actually club mosses. They're actually a lower vascular plant. I'd like them to look at the variation in colors that they see, that they might see some ferns growing up there in addition to the mosses. And if they can't climb trees for whatever reason, I would ask them to start looking on the ground for fallen branches, because that is a way to unlock the secrets of the canopy, is to see what the canopy has yielded when a branch falls down, when a clump of these epiphytes fall down. And if they start just pulling it apart and looking at the diversity of different forms of mosses, they don't have to know the names of the mosses. That doesn't matter. But just how many different kinds of mosses they can discern once they have those moss mats in their hands, I think they'll gain a real appreciation of the diversity that lives up there. And I guess finally, I would ask them to take those mosses and just scrunch them up against their faces and smell them, because they smell so good, so rich and organic. And so the canopy is a place not only of scientific study, but it's a very sensual place. It's a very beautiful place, and it's a place where humans can just enjoy it.
Well, we're out of time, but what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
The message that I hope you take away is that there is a world above the forest floor. There's a third dimension to forest ecosystems that's beautiful, that's diverse, and that's key in terms of healthy forests.
Thanks so much for being here, Nalini.
You're welcome.
We have just been speaking with Nalini Nadkarni, a member of the faculty at the Evergreen State College. For more information, check on the web at www.nalininadkarni.com. Again, that's NalininNadkarni.com. On May 29th and 30th at the Seattle Repertory's Leo K. Theater, you are invited to hear Nalini speak about the complexity and fragility of the rainforest prior to the modern dance performance Biome. Again, that's May 29th and 30th at Seattle Repertory's Leo K. Theater. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and kexp.org.